Welcome. I'm going to call this meeting of the House Committee on Veterans and Emergency Preparedness to order for Tuesday, May 12, 2015. Today we'll have an informational hearing on the Cascadia event, tsunami plans and preparations, and all the other things that relate to that. So I want to first thank everybody that's taken the time today to come provide testimony. So we have five people, so I don't know if we have an order. Since I only call two or three, so shall I call the two elected officials first, the mayor and the county commissioner first, and then we'll go from there. Thank you very much. Came from different parts of the state, so.
Yeah, we all.
Just please identify yourself for the record.
I want to start, okay. Good afternoon. My name is George Endicott. I am the mayor of Redmond, Oregon, and also I was the local government representative to the governor's task force on resilience plan implementation. And hello, Representative Boone. We were
welcome, Mr. Mayor.
We were cohorts on that particular group. So anyway, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, for allowing me to say a few words today. I'd like to point out some of the details on the recommendation that were discussed at the task force. We did do quite a bit of work with the Land Conservation and Development Commission through the DLCD, the Department of Land Conservation and Development, and talked a lot about the impact of the Cascadia event and the tsunami, tsunamis, I guess, that would result from that. Furthermore, the task force recommended that the L line be adopted as the inundation line for all of the coastal communities. And of course, when you look at that, you see that there's some huge impacts on some of those communities, which, of course, as a local government official, has me greatly concerned about my fellow mayors and cities along the coast. To the point that, this is a sidebar, but we were the next that were supposed to actually get funding from the state to do some long-range planning, and I actually told DLCD we would give that money up and get it to the coastal community so they could start doing their long-range planning, because I see them as more of a need than we have in Redmond. During our deliberations, I recommended, and I don't know that it made it to you, but one that, of course, we've already talked about, Line L. But over and above that, I was recommending that we look at what I was calling a just-in-case scenario, where when you look at the inundation lines, you see that a lot of those communities, we don't know how bad the impact's going to be, but we certainly know that a lot of that land as a result is going to be unbuildable. And so my recommendation was, and in fact working with DLCD, was to look at a way to establish an urban reserve area so that, let's say hypothetically, a city lost 200 acres and they could identify an urban reserve area of 200 acres. So without going through the very rigorous land use process to be able to rebuild that community after, in post tsunami and post Cascadia event times. So those were my principal recommendations that I wanted to outline to you today. And of course, as you will hear, I think, later from Mr. Raskin, that there's a great concern over the infrastructure and how all of that's going to happen. One last thing I'd like to say is Redmond Airport has been identified as the primary recovery site for the state of Oregon by FEMA. And so I've been spending an inordinate amount of time trying to figure out how we are going to prepare our city, even though, I mean, we'll have some impact from the earthquake, but we're more concerned about how are we going to be able to offer all of those recovery services to the rest of the state. So I've been convening groups locally in Redmond and, you know, Red Cross, State Police, and so forth to figure those things out for ourselves. So thank you. I'd be happy to entertain any questions.
Sure. Why don't we let the commissioner, then we'll ask questions. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, certainly. Members, and specifically Representative Boone, who's my representative.
Honorable Commissioner.
My name is Mark Labhart, and I have the privilege of being a Tillamook County Commissioner. I've been a commissioner for 11 years. There in Tillamook, lived in Tillamook for about 30 years. Prior to that, was the manager of the majority of the Tillamook State Force, so significant background in that area. One other thing that I think is going to help a little bit, I just have the privilege of being selected as the West Coast representative for the what they call the MITFLAG, which is the FEMA's National Mitigation Hazard Leadership Committee. Just had my first meeting this week ago, and there's a representative from Georgia and from Wisconsin who also just got appointed to this MITFLAG group. Our job is to represent, at least I'm representing the West Coast, on tsunami preparedness, mitigation, earthquake preparedness, and I represent the counties. And I had the privilege of working with Mayor Endicott on the governor's task force as a representative from the Association of Oregon Counties. So I'm going to scare you just a little bit. You've probably already been scared already by a number of things, but then I'll get to my point after I scare you just a little bit. And I think you know that yesterday there was another earthquake in Nepal that is going to devastate that country even more. And every time I see major earthquakes in either Peru or Indonesia or Japan or Nepal, I keep saying, thank God it hasn't happened to us yet. So this is the little town of Neskowin. Neskowin is in the very south corner of Tillamook County. There was a number of elected officials. Previous Governor Kitzhaber used to have a place in Neskowin. Secretary of State Brown, I think, has a second home there. Governor Brown has a second home there, and a few others. So there's this is Neskowin after some coastal erosion issues that affected this seawall. This is one of the motels in Neskowin being impacted by an ocean wave. They have a population of about 200 full-time people, and then, of course, during the summer months when people recreate there, their population goes up significantly. This is what happens in the aftermath of when you get that ocean inundation, I would call it. You get logs that come in from the ocean, and they wash up this little creek here called Hawk Creek. This is a really nice place to eat called Hawk Creek Cafe. Those waves that were bouncing up onto the decks here are right in this area right here. What happens is these big logs come up here, and there's a bridge right here. It's the only access in and out of the majority of Neskowin. And hanging on that bridge are water line, sewer line, electrical lines, and that bridge is an extremely old county bridge, and the logs will float with the tide and wash up against that bridge. So we have to come in and do some work on that. So coastal erosion is not just an issue in the little town of Neskowin. We know it's an erosion, and we know it's an issue up and down the entire Oregon coast. You may have remembered a few years ago, Senator Hatfield had a place in this community called the Capes in Tillamook. Mm-hmm. There was coastal erosion issues that started wearing away the seawall here. It's a large sand wall. It was noticed in 1997 by the local landowners. The lawns there dropped some 18 inches. 5 more feet drop were added just a few weeks later. And then the main area of movement was 900 feet long and 500 feet wide, endangered 10 house and 10 more at risk. And then there was a Department of Geology and Mineral Industries report in 2002 and said this: the Cape's private housing community experienced landslide and coastal erosion damage associated with the 1997-98 El Nino event. Residents were evacuated and short-term mitigation was implemented. Long-term mitigation options which need to accommodate coastal building regulations are still being evaluated. 1997-98. Yeah. Long-term recommendations are still being evaluated. Land use recommendations. So you've seen this chart, I'm sure, many times. Of course, we're here. We've passed a 75% reoccurrence level. This is what scares me: a 30% chance of a magnitude 9 in the next 50 years. That's almost better odds than you can get in Vegas. 30% chance in the next 50 years, almost a 1 in 3. So this is, of course, Japan before the tsunami, Japan after the tsunami, and that's this community. And you think about Seaside, Cannon Beach, Rockaway Beach, Pacific City, and just start going up and down the entire Oregon coast, and that's what you see. Wastewater systems fail. This is a sewer manhole that popped out of the ground. Electrical systems fail. liquid fuel systems fail. We know that the majority of our liquid fuel is located in Portland. We know that it's located on some liquefied sand. And, of course, road systems fail. And I'm sure you've heard the discussions from ODOT about all the bridges that they're going to fail. But it's not only state bridges, it's county bridges, it's city bridges, it's city infrastructures, it's county infrastructure. The ports are going to be damaged. This is Cannon Beach in 1964 after the tsunami hit there. The bridge was located right about here, went right across there. This is on the north end of Cannon Beach, and these are the two pieces of the bridge that got hit by the tsunami and washed up shore. So this is kind of interesting. The land area in Oregon is 99,000 square miles. There's 296 miles of coastline. The population exposed to a tsunami is 22,200 people, just the tsunami inundation areas. Residential buildings, this is an estimate now, probably close to 500,000 could be damaged. Short-term human sheltering requirements, 500,000 people. And that's if, you know, we don't have severe impacts in Portland, Salem, Eugene. Pets. I've got a 14-year-old chocolate lab, and it's part of the family. And it's just as important as any other part of our family. Pets are going to have issues. Mass feeding hydration requirements, 1 million people. Mass feeding and hydration requirements, about 700,000. Just an estimate, 4,000 deaths. Most of us are going to survive. It's the disaster after the disaster that scares me. How long are we going to be on our own? How long is it going to take George and his crews to get to us? And how are they going to get to us? Injuries, 15,000 people. We don't have enough hospitals and doctors to be able to address all that. Hospital patient evacuation requirements, nursing home evacuations, building debris, all kinds of things that most people don't think about, but we as government officials need to think about that. Okay, made your point. So we know it's going to be bad. We know it's going to be a disaster. We know that there's going to be a major disaster after disaster. We know we're going to be on our own for a while. And so what are you going to do about it? Well, we have. There's been some good leadership provided with the Oregon Resilience Plan. Took a long time to put this together. We need to work together to begin to implement the provisions of the Resilience Plan and the ones that we can afford to implement. It is so easy for U.S. legislators to deal with the day-to-day issues that bite you all the time. It is very difficult for U.S. legislators to say, I need to get up to 50,000 feet, and I need to look beyond just the day-to-day issues that are biting me and start thinking about what's going to happen to this state when we have an event like this. And it's so easy just to go back in the weeds and say, you know, I've got constituents knocking on my door every 15 minutes wanting us to do this and this and this. And it's very difficult, I believe, for you as elected official, I know, to look at 50,000 feet and say we've got to start addressing some of the stuff that's in this resilience plan. There's been some work done at the local level. Tillamook County has implemented some provisions derived from a three-year community-driven effort, bottom-up effort. It's called the Coastal Neskowin Erosion Adaptation Plan. While it specifically deals with some of the things I showed you earlier about coastal erosion, many of the provisions could apply to future development along the Oregon coast. So here's what we passed an ordinance in our county. The Department of Land Conservation is considering using this ordinance as a template for the rest of the Oregon coast. We as elected officials need to not only deal with our day-to-day issues, but look to the eventual future, and we know what the future holds for our coastline. This plan, this ordinance, requires a certified engineering geologist to certify the safest site on the property. It requires that any structure be set back 50 times the annual erosion rate now, plus 20 feet, and it provides the ability to reduce the front setback for the right to accommodate this. It limits density to one single-family dwelling in the zone, that's the hazard zone, regardless of the underlying zone on the ground. This means no two-family residence can be built. It requires that in any land division, at least 1,500 square foot building pad be provided outside of the zone. Properties fully within the zone are not eligible for division. and requires movable structure design in the zone. In other words, being able to pick up the house and move it back if you get coastal erosion. Requires that a certified engineering geologist certify the development be within an acceptable level of risk. So it also provides guidance for minimal disturbance of the lot during development. And this is the tsunami on, this is all the development that occurred right there on the beachfront that's no longer there in Indonesia. Allows the staff the discretion to contract out peer reviews of the submitted report in instances where the certified engineering geologist might be in question. So you don't get this dueling geologist thing. That's what happened at the Capes. They had a geologist come in and say, oh, it's perfectly safe. Another geologist came in and said, no, I don't know about this. Well, anyway, it failed, and so the county has to end up dealing with the issue in the long run. So nearly every bullet point that I just mentioned real rapidly here could be translated into tsunami planning. Because it's not only the coastal erosion issues that we're talking about, it's tsunami planning and how we can deal with that along the entire Oregon coast. Extremely controversial. Very controversial. It was tough for us politically to make decisions like this. And we said, no, we need to step up to the plate and we need to address issues like this in our county. It needs to be made clear that the tsunami inundation area is much larger and higher in elevation than the Nesquen Coastal Hazards Plan. And so more work is needed. So this, I hope you've seen some of these maps. They've been produced by the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. The inundation area, the estimated inundation area for a tsunami is the dark area that you see there, the purple areas. And I picked went to Clatsop County and grabbed this one. This is the inundation area. There's a high school there. There's a grade school there. There's businesses there. There's the Highway 101. All these little tiny white spots that you see in there, those are all houses. And you say, yeah, I already heard about Seaside, but then you go to Rockaway Beach. Rockaway Beach on the 4th of July, I do the Rockaway Beach 4th of July parade every year. There's probably 10,000 people in downtown Rockaway Beach on the 4th of July. Every one of the motel rooms are full. The entire length of Rockaway Beach is gone in a tsunami inundation zone. And so in that city, do we continue to allow development right on the beachfronts? Do we continue to allow schools to be built in Seaside in the inundation zones? You know, these are questions. So, okay, Mark, so what else are you doing? We've developed sister county relationships. Our community development director has developed a county sister relationship with Umatilla County. What? Why would you want to do that? Well, here's what... here's the reasons why. We've done five of these. Association of Oregon Counties has done five of these, and with a couple cities also. We have worked with their boards and councils to communicate this initiative. We meet annually with the respective board and county commissioners, develop a memorandum of understanding with each county leadership needs for their needs and resources, develop and commit yearly resources estimated to sustain sister relationships, find and obtain resources to sustain those relationships, annually and officially submit public works director helicopter priority names and contact information, sign mutual aid agreements, and confirm all public works staff meet ICS requirements. So why would we want to do this? Well, Leanne Welch is our public works director, really great lady, and one of the top in the state. Well, as soon as this disaster hits, hopefully she survives, but if she doesn't, we're still going to need a public works director. We've got that relationship with the Umatilla County Public Works Director. She can't work 24 hours a day, and so we're going to set up a relationship where we can have that public works director from Umatilla County come over and help us out and help relieve those services. And vice versa, if Umatilla County ever gets into a situation with flooding or some kind of a disaster, we're willing to send over our public works director. So we need to have that relationship to ship resources back and forth so that we can help each other out. So these are the counties and cities that are currently interested in participating. There's Mr. Endicott's city right there. And you can see some of the other cities and counties. Department of Land Conservation and Development has prepared guidelines to assist local governments and communities in becoming more resilient. They've prepared a land use guide for Oregon Coastal. I'm just going to summarize this now. DLCD has been a very good partner. In the work that they provided valuable technical assistance, and one of them's right back here. and support, but usually, as usual, financial resources would also be needed to help continue this work. Providing DLC with grant resources to pass on to local governments will likely be critical to any resilience planning and work that we need to accomplish along the coastal strip and even into the valley where the earthquake tsunami could hit. Land use guidance focuses on three areas: life safety, zoning, and incentives. Then we also have some local resources. You know, I've talked about the feds, I've talked about the state, I've talked about the county, I've talked about cities, but we also have local resources, volunteer resources. All of these players need to be part of this preparedness level. This group called the Emergency Volunteer Corps of Nehalem Bay, deeply committed, and they've got a core of like-minded volunteers that have forced a remarkable public-private coalition in three small coastal towns, which is one of the most visionary, I believe, innovative, and organized local emergency preparedness groups in the United States. And this was came from a gentleman that used to work for the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, who I called Dr. Death. He was the guy that went around to everybody and talked about how bad the earthquake's going to be, and James Roddy. So the Emergency Volunteer Corps, they started from nothing, and now they have 112 trained community emergency response team members. They have 116 certified members from the high school. They go right into the classroom and train the CERT volunteers in the high school. 133 Map Your Neighborhood captains and co-captains, community-based neighbor and neighbor programs. How many of you live in a neighborhood and you don't even know your neighbors? Or if you do know your neighbors, is the little old lady that's on oxygen, do you know what's going to happen to her? Is she taken care of? What about her husband? What about people in wheelchairs? How are you going to deal with that? That's what these co-captains do. They go in there and they start talking to their neighbors about what happens if we have an event. We have 42 Red Cross certified volunteers, 54 ham radio operators. Most of our communication systems are going to fail. We know that. Cell phones are going to be down. Landlines are going to be down. We've had 15 presidentially declared disasters in our county since 1996. And a lot of times, ham radios are the only communication that we have, and they're very effective. 33 Registered Medical Volunteer Corps. Our physicians, our doctors, our nurse practitioners are going to be overwhelmed, but we have a number of retired doctors, nurse practitioners, and nurses that we've, thanks to your help, we got a law passed last legislative session so that they can get rid of that liability issue about being able to help people so that they can come in as a previous doctor and be able to provide services in an emergency, just like a Good Samaritan law, so that doctors can be able to do that, because we're going to need these folks. We're going to look at what's going on in Nepal right now about doctors and nurses and being able to assist those folks, and these retired folks who live along our coastal communities are willing to help. So how are they funded? Well, they're funded by themselves. The cities help a little bit, but they also raise money on their own, and they fund themselves. They've got an emergency plan, shelters, supplies pre-positioned, water and sanitation, backup pre-planning, and they've got leadership, and that's a key. They've worked with communities throughout Tillamook County to support the community preparedness efforts. And then they're helping to spread this throughout Tillamook County. We need to spread this out through the entire Oregon coast and maybe even further than that. So what's the message? The Oregon Resilience Plan's got 100 and some recommendations. I testified before this committee before on some of the priority recommendations. I hope that you consider some of those priority recommendations for funding the Oregon Resilience Plan. We've done our homework. When I had a chance, last week I had a chance to talk to the Homeland Security Director for Environmental Services, Dr. Pullman. She was out here doing a review of some of our projects along the coastal strip, and I talked to her about our Oregon Resilience Plan. And she says, you know, this is something we need to take back to Washington, D.C., because you and Oregon have your act together. You've got a resilience plan. You've done your homework. Now we need to implement the plan. And so that's pretty nice coming from the Director of Homeland Security. So what we're talking about here is Oregon's future. We're talking about your families. We're talking about your children, and we're talking about your grandchildren. I have three grandchildren. They're pretty special to me. It would be easy to just say we can't afford it and let it go. You're under those kind of pressures all the time. Can't afford it. Duh. Maybe it's going to happen, maybe not. They did that in Nepal. And there's somebody's child, somebody's grandchild. There's people that didn't make it. And there's a lot of people there. These are some of the survivors. Maybe that's your grandchild. Maybe that's your child. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Representative Boone.
Thank you. Can I jump in there right away? Commissioner Labhart, you mentioned in the very last part, funding certain parts of it. There are three bills that are in play right now. All three are down in Ways and Means. Senate Bill 808 is a bill I'm co-sponsoring with Senator Monis Anderson. That is the Oregon Resilience Plan Part 2, basically the human services side. There's Senate Bill 94, which is that I gut and stuffed my own bill to address the tanks, the liquid fuel tanks, and help them with some innovative funding and financing with local governments and private sector, et cetera, to do the seismic upgrades they're going to need. And then House Bill 2270, which is the resilience policy advisor position in the governor's office. Senate Bill 808, the plan, has about $300,000 fiscal on it. There's possibility of lowering that a little bit. We did the other one very, very inexpensively. I think it was free. Oregon Military Department and OEM took part in that. And we're not sure what's going to happen there, but for the money part, 2270 is about 300 for 2 years in the governor's office. And she remains very interested in these bills too. And 94, I don't think it has a fiscal on it, or it shouldn't, because it's not asking for money from the state. And then the last one we've got in that's in place still is Senate Bill 93, and that is the 90-day prescription that drugs that you can get at a pharmacy. And I know there are several more. There's a House Bill 2633 that is similar to the Tillamook County that coastal hazards. And I wondered if you're involved with that at all, or how that figures in with that.
Chair Lively, Representative Boone, no, I'm not familiar with that one. But the others, I am, and I can tell you on behalf of the Association of Oregon Counties, which I represent, we support all of those.
Okay.
So I do need to get up to speed on that second one. So.
Well, and I'm making some notes here, and I'll give you this page so you can have it to continue your lobby effort. But I really appreciate all that everybody's done. I have to just say, and I know I've said it before, so stop me if I get repetitive, and that is that I never expected this to get this big and to be this comprehensive. And all the people who came together on it from all the sectors, it's just incredible. And it's been going on, 4 years now, maybe, about? And the folks at the beach, at the coastal communities, as Commissioner Labhart has said, are in the front lines in that sense, and that's the most serious impact. But not to say that there aren't going to be impacts inland too. And the thing that we're very worried about too is what's going to happen on the Columbia River. And we've had all kinds of new people join the effort, and it's just, I feel amazed that so many people now are part of this, even not the usual suspects. So. Both of these guys up here and the guys back there too have been, I think everybody in this room has had a piece of this. And for example, Mayor Endicott is going to be it's going to be the focus on Central Oregon, because that's where they have the tarmac that's thick enough to land the heavy planes, etc., and to have a place that's going to be fairly safe to store things and stage from. And so he jumped in early, early on. And Senator Johnson, hey, come and sit with us.
Yeah. Thanks for blowing my cover. I just wanted to give Commissioner Labhart a message.
I have a bill next door that she was testifying.
Oh, okay, got it. Okay. All right. Anyway, I'll quit now, but a big thank you to everybody. And we're not done yet, but it's overwhelming to me, the support that we've received on these things. And they're actually fairly small amounts of money when you think about it. And we're not going to talk about the seismic upgrade, you know, program, but that is a whole other conversation. So everything that's happening is part of the whole picture, and I really appreciate everybody's work.
Representative Evans.
Thank you, Chair Lively. Commissioner, always good to see you. Yep. Mayor.
Thank you.
I used to be mayor, so I appreciate the particular type of responsibility you have. One of the things that, as looking at this, one of the questions, a policy question that you don't have to have an answer to, but it would be helpful to see your response. If there was an option, if there was a system development charge dedicated specifically for resiliency, something that would be locally derived and have local control for investments, leveraging shared investments, perhaps for moving things out of the inundation areas, or perhaps buying properties that shouldn't be there in the first place. Is that a tool that the counties would look to, or the cities would look to, as a viable option?
Chair Lively, Representative, I can't speak to that on behalf of the Association of Counties because we haven't been asked that question. I can speak to it on behalf of at least myself as a Tillamook County Commissioner. You bet. We would look at that. I mean, user pays. If you're going to build in that area, and you're going to build in an earthquake zone, an inundation zone, a hazard zone, whatever the zones are, and you know full well that you're going to be there's going to be additional resources that are going to have to be put into that, I would think it would be appropriate to say we can put in a fee that would go toward helping to address this either from a land use standpoint or you know, maybe we need to put in a different road system. Maybe we need to put in a different sewer system, those kind of things to address these kind of things. User pays kind of a thing rather than, well, okay, the state's got to pay it all. So I would be supportive of that.
Thank you. And I, Mr. Chair and Representative, I think that, excuse me, from a city's perspective, you know, one of the things that I brought up early on in our implementation task force was the need to address water and wastewater. Mm-hmm. If you go down and look at what happened with Katrina in New Orleans, you know, the two big things that we heard about was clean water and, of course, clean wastewater systems, which they didn't have. And you know, if we're going to go in and try and help people recover, they have to be alive to be able to help them, right? And I mean, I don't want to sound too crude about it, but it really is an issue that we have to figure out a way to get clean water and wastewater systems to help those folks survive. And so I could even see the need for some sort of a pool to include SDCs, maybe other funds as well, but that we have some money set aside to be able to provide for some of those emergency services that might be needed in a community.
Mr. Chair, follow-up.
Sure.
Follow-up question is similar thinking, different mechanism. In the past couple years, there's been some sporadic conversations, again, around trying to find money to pay for the seismic resilience and investment approaches that are out there, one of which was basically looking at trying to find a way to bond out for specific types of equipment, whether they be 1 year rescue boats, the next year generators, the next year fill in the blank, but things that are force multipliers for the initial 24 to 72 to 84 hours out that could be on a lend lease, where they're state-owned, but they're maintained by the locals, and at the end of 10 or 15 years, when they have basically depreciated out, they become your property if you want them, but that they're standardized by state purchase. Not a lot of extra bells and whistles for Taylor. That'd be up to the local, but if those types of things were available, building on the model that many cities use for the UASI stuff, is that something that locals and counties would be interested in, you think?
Mr. Chairman and Representative, I think that probably the simple answer is yes. Just to tell you some of the things that we've done, we know, for example, that we're going to lose power.
Right.
For anywhere, we are right on the main grid for Bonneville, but it will be down for a few days to a few weeks. And so we have lined up all of those kinds of resources already for our community, to include fuel. I mean, fuel's huge because we aren't going to have any, and we've already heard about what's going to happen to the tanks. So we've been working on things like contracts over in Idaho to get fuel delivery to us, and it's certainly easier for us than, say, the valley or the coast to try and get fuel from those areas to the east. So I think what you're proposing is something a la or akin to what we're already doing. But again, as you heard Representative Boone say, you know, I've been interested, especially for our community, for a long time in this issue. And we've been working to line things up because we don't want to get caught short when it happens, not if it happens, as folks keep saying.
Chair Lively, Representatives, what I like about your conversation is you're thinking outside the box. And that's what, I don't know if we can answer all the questions today, but we need to have this kinds of discussions continuing with the Resilience Task Force and the Resilience Plan to look at these kind of out-of-the-box thinking, because we can't say, oh, the state's going to rush in here and save us all. They've got plenty of money. The feds are going to do that. I mean, you heard me talk about the volunteer efforts, that, and they did that through their own fundraisers. And maybe there's a partnership, but we need to have the discussions among ourselves as a state of Oregon, people who care about different options and what we can do and not do. And there's going to be controversies back and forth about how to do things, but we need to have those discussions to start moving us in that direction.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. And I'm sorry, excuse me for being late. I had a bill on the other Veterans Committee that I testified on. So I had a conversation with a different agency head, different issue this morning, who was, well, not the agency head, but someone who came on one of the agency budgets and you know, supporting the agency budget and saying, well, you know, we have volunteers to do that work, and I appreciate the work of volunteers. And my comment to him was, relying on volunteers is not a plan. I mean, it's helpful, and we appreciate volunteers when they show up, but we have an obligation, I think, as the state to address these issues. And, you know, when I look at, and I take a different position than, I've never been a mayor, take a different position than Rep. Evans is going to. I mean, scooping up all the people off the coast and telling them don't live there is not a plan. And yet the coast generates a lot of income for the entire state through tourism, through fishing, through a number of things. I think we have an obligation to make investments at the state level into these hotspots where we're going to have issues when we have an earthquake, whatever that looks like, whether that's a bond match program to help. You can't, Tillamook County can't raise all the money you need to do all the infrastructure work. That's just not, and yet Tillamook County generates revenue for the state. I mean, and so, we have an important relationship with our particular coastal communities, certainly Central Oregon is a piece of that as well in terms of the tourism. We have to make that a state priority. We can't just expect that your taxpayers are going to pick up that tab for all of this and not have a thoughtful bond match type program that builds the infrastructure that you need. So that's more just commentary than anything. One of the questions I do have, though, is your county and your cities have to be able to pick up the next day and govern. So in your resiliency plans, and as we talk about what we do with this building on the seismic, you know, I'm not interested personally in prioritizing the capital over places where you're gonna have really important needs. I am interested, however, for the capital and the purpose of governing the next day after an event, of making sure that all of our records and data and the things we need to function are backed up redundantly somewhere outside of the zone so that the computer can turn on the next day and we can, government can keep going. So where is that in your resiliency plans? Because that is one thing I, in 5 years on this committee, haven't heard a lot of about the technology to make sure that city and county government on the coast is being backed up and stored somewhere so that, you know, whoever sort of left to pick up the pieces doesn't lose the digital record, doesn't lose, you know, where things are at and how to move forward, and doesn't actually lose your resiliency plan because your county buildings crumble. Well,
Chair Leavitt, Representative Parrish, very good points. What we've done, at least in Tillamook County, I only speak for us, is we're moving stuff to the cloud so that data and storage, of course, data and storage on site, but we're moving a lot of our stuff to the cloud so that we can access it remotely. We have a huge issue. Our courthouse was built in, you know, it's 83 years old, unreinforced masonry. You're right, it's going to collapse. And if the judges and the commissioners and the elected officials are in there, we're probably not going to survive. And so we've got a system in place, a backup plan on who's going to be in charge when this, if this isn't, person isn't available and those kind of things. But, you know, counties, cities need to start looking at off-site. I know there's a lot of information that's stored over in Eastern Oregon at the site there in Burns. We need to look at, you know, I am a supporter of the Capitol being renovated, but I also am a supporter of, we need to spread some of that bond money out to communities, as you say, not just do the Capitol, but spread that bond money out to retrofit schools, to retrofit government buildings, those kind of things, so that we can have some form of government in place when it does happen. And we not only save the Capitol, but we save other governmental buildings.
Can I follow up?
Sure.
Well, I've looked at a lot of sort of disasters that we've had in the last few decades, and one of the things that I think has been effective is that they've been able to sort of, their governments have been able to get up and respond, and the ones who haven't been able to get up or respond, obviously their people have suffered longer. And so, you know, when I look at, and the question I guess I would have is, what would it take to get your county backed up somewhere so that if business had to go on the next day, that you're, you know, you could operate out of a yurt in Eastern Oregon and still have Tillamook County government running? I mean, for me, more than the buildings, it's the prioritization of making sure that the record isn't lost, that the ability to function and have that history. I mean, the Capitol's burned down twice in its 150 years. We've had two fires already, and there's been a fire in this building even after it was constructed. They were able to put it out, and the building didn't burn to the ground. But the reality is, I'm trying to sort of piece together the pre-1935 history of our laws, and that stuff's all over the place. I mean, I'm having to buy it on eBay, and I'm having to, you know, dig through old records and things to try to piece together that first, you know, 50 years of our, plus 50 plus 80 years of our government, because it was gone. And so, you know, if you don't know where you came from, it's hard to know where you're going. What's it going to take to, you know, as for me, that would be my, I don't live in Tillamook, but that would be my first prioritization for any of these projects is, can your government function the next day? And what's it going to cost to get that, make that happen? And what kind of investment do we as a state need to make? $320 million to back up every state government versus just fixing the Capitol feels a lot more effective use of our money. I don't even think it would take $320 million to take every city and county and make sure that their records are protected and they can function the next day.
Sure, love your very good points. Are we going to be back in business today? No, ma'am, we are not. We're going to be, we're going to get blasted back to the Stone Age, and it's going to be very difficult. Even if we're off-site, we're not going to have power for very long. We have generators, and our generators are going to run as long as the gas runs and the diesel runs, and then we're out of that. And so we're going to have some laptops. We're going to have some satellite communications, but it's going to be limited. We're going to be on a survival mode basis until we can get going. I have, you know, I'm somewhat familiar with this kind of thing. I'm what they call a Type 1 Incident Commander. I spent 11 years fighting forest fires as a Type 1 Incident Commander, and then I got picked to be one of five people nationwide to be what they call an Area Commander, and that's when the disaster of the disasters hit. Like, I was the area commander on the Biscuit Fire, the half-a-million-acre fire, and sent down there to visit with the president about how to resolve this disaster. I was on a million-acre fire in Nevada. And so I see when disasters really become disasters. And what you do, you bring in expertise, you bring it from the outside, bring in these national teams that were at Katrina, that were at 9/11, and to help that community try to at least for a while survive and then get back to normal. We need to have a further discussion on exactly what you bring up, is not only of our history, but how do we get back operating our records? How do we retain, you know, let's just use an example of property taxes. How do we continue to collect property taxes when we don't have a system in place that can collect property taxes? And we know what property taxes fund. We don't. Well, how do you collect gas taxes when there's no gas? We need to start thinking about those kind of things and having that discussion through the resilience planning effort. And your points are extremely valid.
I've never seen it in 5 years that that's been I hear a lot about buildings and hear a lot about, you know, schools. And obviously, I'm a mom with kids, like making sure your schools are seismic. We hear the story about the guy who, I think you've told it to us, who take the fastest guy in town and how fast can he run out of town and is he going to beat the tsunami? And the answer is no. But what I have yet to hear in 5 years is that how do we preserve the ability to move forward the next day as a society? And that would be my first priority as an investment from the state before we pick any one single building and prioritize it, is how do we prioritize preserving governments for every level of government, and get it somewhere backed up in Idaho or backed up somewhere that if we go down, we can turn on the computers the next day somewhere in the country and still run our local government. I mean, it's a problem, and I'd like to start to ring that bell. Today, for me, is ringing that bell.
I'm glad you're concerned, and I'm glad you care about it. I appreciate that.
Mr. Chair and Representative Parrish, you don't know this, but I'm a retired strategic planner from Department of Defense, and so we have the concept of COOP, which is continuity of operations, and we spend a lot of time on that very issue that you're bringing up. And probably the single biggest, I'll call it the long pole in the tent, which is a term we use, is communications. We heard about the ham operators already from my fellow panelist here, and if we have communications, we stand a chance. But we know it's those ham operators, and you know, at least initially, we're trying to save lives and get things like water and so forth into those areas. And to be honest, I think for the first few days, we aren't caring a whole lot about property taxes. We're paying attention to survival of those people and then trying to get the things they need to actually make it through the next few days. But you are very well on target with the long-term issues that we're going to have to deal with. And that was certainly some of the things that our task force looked at, was how do we recover and get those things back in place once they're lost. It's a huge issue, and I'm glad you're paying attention to it because we all care about it.
I just wanted to weigh in, too, is that if you, I'm downloading it now, the Oregon Resilience Plan, it's the big one. Mm-hmm. It does address those things, and it isn't going to be possible to just switch on a computer next day. Mm-hmm. You might have some information up in the cloud, but as far as getting back to, that's one of the first recommendations, is to figure out basically taking care of people first.
Oh, yeah,
and that's there. But getting, you know, assessing buildings, there's here it is. This is the whole plan. It's all in there, the big chapters. But assessing building safety, there's all kinds of strategies that are set out in the plan for how to go about that. Getting business back, getting electricity back. That's why we're working so hard on ocean energy, to get some forms of power on the other side where the transmission lines will be down and we won't have them. And we're told transmission will not be restored as it is today for 3 to 4 years.
It's
we did address it in there. There are no magic answers, but there's, as you all remember when it started out, it was like, get, you know, 3 days worth of prep. Now it's like 28 gallons of water per person. You know, start with that. And that's not for bathing. That's for just, you know, maintaining health.
But believe me, when I bring this up, it's not because I want you to have a city council meeting the next day.
not going to happen.
No. Pretty sure that's not the priority. But if your key leaders who know what the plan is somehow are gone, someone needs to be able to access that plan. Somewhere that plan needs to live and exist, where you know how to, you know, get what are the steps, or where is that information, or someone who can step in and really understand, like, where are your plans? Where are the plans for your county, for facilities and buildings and maintenance and gas pipes and all of those things? If you're gone and you're the keeper of that knowledge, that has to exist somewhere so you can even start to rebuild. And so I've just personally not seen that sort of records keeping and maintenance come forward ever in a bill, but our prioritization of funding from this organization, from our legislature, to say that should be our first sort of level of funding rather than a building, making that a priority.
Representative, do you have another question or comment?
Comment real brief. Several years ago, Executive Order 0820 was put into place by Governor Kulongoski that laid out simultaneous response and recovery planning. That was one of the ways in which the December 2007-2008 storms.
You had a role in that, didn't you?
I did, yeah. The ability to simultaneously respond with some of the folks that are not in the response chain but in the how we're going to put Humpty Dumpty back together again chain in the other room led to some synergies in terms of where we were investing and how fast we could get certain things up. I highly encourage those types of things to continue. The one thing we were not able to do that I hope is in the plan, at least from what I've read, it talks about it, but it doesn't necessarily have a strategy for it. So, Mayor, please help push that down the road. Pre-deployment investments and pre-deployment risk, meaning yep. that the state is on the hook anytime we are going to be paying for part of a disaster, and there's generally a hesitancy of not wanting to roll the hardware because, well, if it doesn't happen, we're out X number of dollars. And figuring out what percentage of that risk is acceptable so that maybe we're not rolling out everything, but we're rolling out 25% or 50 or whatever it is, because you're buying down the cost of the disaster, you're buying down the cost in lives. And having pre-deployed assets and pre-deployed rally points where instead of everybody trying to go out and find people that are hurt, having places that people, if they are hurt, know to go to, minimizes the chaos. So some of that tiered investments I hope to see in plans as they develop. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and Representative Evans, if I can respond. And I'll do this by way of an example. The mayor of Yahats is a good friend of mine, and he was telling me that they have two containers. Now, they're not a very big community. They have two containers in town full of stuff, water, cots, blankets, and all that, one of which is on his property because he's above the inundation zone. So, you know, some communities have taken a leadership role for themselves to provide for themselves, and I'm glad to see some of the coastal communities doing that. What I don't have is a handle on how many have done that, and I think you're right on that the state should and could encourage that. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mayor Endicott and I talked earlier today, and you know, I know there's the resilience plan, and if we move forward with some of the work that we're doing, this session will identify some leadership that can start prioritizing. You know, one thing we're going to have to do as a body is determine at some point how much are we going to commit per biennium to resilience and preparedness. Is it going to be $100 million per biennium? Is it going to be $1 billion? What are we going to be willing as a body to bite off for planning for the things that everybody's been talking about here? And to a certain extent, you know, we're dabbling around the edges this session. Commissioner Labhart brings up the capital reconstruction project. Do we do it? Do we not do it? Where is it on the priority list? I always interject as one of the budget people is, you know, understanding what our commitment is and our priority of commitments. I'm on the Capital Foundation Board, so I'm a little prejudiced, but I'll try not to be. But the Capitol Building is a state-owned facility. K-12 buildings are not, and though I support bonds for seismic retrofitting of schools, I support that. I said so last week in the capital construction hearing, but that also needs, we need to take politics out of that, partisan posturing, and it needs to be a serious discussion about, like we are with courthouses, for example. We've prioritized courthouses. We had a good hearing last Friday on the prioritization because we got together and we determined which courthouses need to be done first, which ones are most vulnerable, and we've worked with AOC and OJD to identify the prioritization list, and we're working through that each biennium. And we need to do the same with schoolhouses and what kinds of bonds, how would that be structured? Are they 11J bonds where we do a dollar for dollar match? or and do we take care of the schoolhouses farthest west first? You know, I mean, what's the prioritization list going to look like on that? So far this session, there's been a lot of fist banging on podiums and pulpits about $300 million for a seismic. I don't think anybody that says that actually has a clue of what $300 million would or wouldn't do. And I've said, I've got some schoolhouses in my district I don't want to put a nickel in. I want to put money into replacing the building, not seismically retrofitting, because they're not worth putting $300,000 or whatever in. So there's a lot of prioritizing that still needs to be done, but we need the folks that have been at the table and Rep Boone and others that, you know, understand what the, and Rep Evans that understand what the real needs are going to be, and then really do a prioritization list and try to keep politics and political posturing out of it so that we can really prioritize and determine how much we're going to commit each biennium to the need.
Thank you. It all sounds too much for me. I'm giving up. Let's call this off. Oh, we'll go on a little bit longer today. So
yeah. I just wanted to bring up, Rep Huffman reminded me of when we were in the seafloor mapping stage of my career here, and that went on for several years. And we ended up doing just that. We prioritized the areas of the coast that would be hit the hardest in this case, and so we needed the best information first on. And it wasn't just, it wasn't, you know, the same with all the mapping and stuff. It wasn't just the east side versus the west side. It was, what do we need to have done now? And just so it doesn't, I'm sure they would come up if we had questions. Oh, Sean's gone now, but Dave Stuckey's in the back, and we've got people from OEM and military department who play a key role in all this, because they're the kind of the head guys on a lot of this stuff. They have done the planning, and they are, you know, they've actually done it, and in some cases, and Commissioner Labhart knows from the flooding in Tillamook and what heroes that they were, you know, for us there, and bringing in both in Vernonia when they flooded there, and it's been, our experience has mostly been storms and flooding right now, but it's kind of, you know, they've been there, they're doing that, they're quietly working the background in the back row there, but they're key to what we're doing here. And I think we if we have questions, I know they'll come up and answer them as to what we're doing and how we can go through with this now in our second stage of this planning. It's so crucial.
So I have a couple of questions, one for the commissioner, one for Mr. Mayor. Mr. Mayor, I'd like to hear a little bit more about your planning for the airport. It's interesting, the designation, and obviously it means more than just to the city of Redmond or even Central Oregon. So I'd like to understand a little bit better kind of where, what the plan is or where you're headed, what things you have to address, I guess, in more of the near term, even the far term.
Right, yeah, Mr. Chairman, thank you. There are several aspects to this that we've been looking at. We had the head of logistics for Region 10 FEMA come to Redmond and talk to us about what their expectations were. We are in the process now of rebuilding our main runway to allow for bigger planes fully loaded. You know, the good news is that they come in loaded, but they leave empty. So, you know, the whole density altitude thing is kind of taken care of if you're a pilot. Sure. They have also established some relationships for staging areas to be able to start staging equipment and vehicles and supplies to be able to move them. I think if you hear from Mr. Stuckey, they have done some pretty extensive planning for moving them from there forward with heavy lift helicopters and so forth. I think he'll be able to talk to you about that. The big issue for us really is coordination. We are in the process of working with the Forest Service, U.S. Forest Service, to build a new interagency emergency operations center on our airport. I mean, the contract was just let a couple of weeks ago. So that will be constructed soon, principally to be used for wildfires, but could also fill in the case of this event. So We're doing an awful lot of logistics work. The coordination work is the hard part with all the various agencies, because we're going to have local, county, state, federal, all there. Excuse the term, but getting in each other's way, trying to figure out who's doing what. Are we going to be able to do vehicle convoys? The backup site is Klamath Falls, Kingsley Field. Okay. So if we have to start using that, how do we convoy from there up to our site? Because as I understand it, our site will still be the coordination center. And in the middle of all of this, refugees.
Yep.
That's right. So here we are trying to push forward and have this huge problem coming at us. So, you know, and how do our police coordinate the state police? All of those people have been at the table. We continue to have meetings, and we do have emergency operations plans for everything but the Cascadia event, which I have now. And I'm, you know, we can look at a volcanic eruption and tell you what we're going to do, but I have a hard time telling you what we're going to do in detail on the Cascadia event. So those documents are being prepared as we speak, and of course, we're relying quite heavily on the state OEM to help us with that.
Sure. And Commissioner, the question I had, I was fascinated by the plans you showed in one of the communities dealing with. Well, you talked first about seawalls and the erosion of the seawalls, but obviously this, if there's a tsunami, it's much bigger than just seawalls. But I was trying to understand the plans you're talking about, locations, alternative pads. Is all that geared towards continuing development now on the coast, regardless of a tsunami, or is that more geared towards the longer-term potential of what would happen with a tsunami? Because I didn't understand.
Sure, I have a good question. It is for the long-term. That's what we're planning for. We're using land use regulations, yep. Land use ordinances, local land use ordinances to say, we still want you to develop along the Oregon coast. Yep. We want you to live here, but you're going to have to do it in a different way than you've done it in the past to address the long-term potential impacts of coastal erosion, earthquakes, and tsunamis. Okay. So that's what these ordinances do.
Sure.
And we're starting in a small community. And the best part about it is, it came from the ground up. It was the community that came up with this plan and this idea. It wasn't the government coming down and saying, we know what's best for you, here's what we're going to do. The community said, we've got coastal erosion issues. Yep. Please come help us to address these issues. And while we're doing it, we want to look at long term. Right. We want to look at the tsunami inundation zone. And should we be designing rules and regulations at the local level to deal with this? You can still develop there. You just have to develop in certain ways differently than you've done in the past.
Great. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Thank you both very much for taking
Thanks
the
for
time
your attention.
To be here.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
So next we have Jay Raskin, Mark Spangler, and Steve McCoy.
Although
I have one thing I want to show.
Is this going to clear it all up, or will this clear it all up, or we're
yeah, Jay's going to take care of that.
Chair Lively and the rest of the committee, I'm very happy to be here. Making Oregon resilient is a long-term effort, and this committee has been part and parcel of doing that. And I want to applaud the committee for the passage of the resilience legislation they've done this term. And I'm delighted that you're looking towards the future sessions as well. We just had I'm the vice chair of OSPAC, and we just had a meeting this morning, and I wanted to share some of the things that happened at this meeting that might be of interest to the committee. One is that we heard from Alice Weevil, the state architect, and she indicated to us that they are in the process of evaluating the 5,000 buildings, which is 21 million square feet of Oregon. So, they are developing basically what do we got and what do they need, and we'll be developing priorities about how to actually make these buildings resilient. So, some of the stuff is being worked on as we speak, which is quite heartening. We also heard from the other thing I wanted to mention was that the Oregon Resilience Plan actually is having national effect. It is actually one of the key documents being used by the National Institute of Standards and Technology to create
the Community Resilience Planning Guidelines, which will be it's a national document that will be coming down. It's in 100% draft form, and people can go online and make comments on, read it and make comments on it. But Oregon is the base document and is highly referenced in that document. So we've had national impact with this effort. Another group that came and talked to us was Clean Energy Works. They're one that came initiative that came originally out of Portland is now a public-private partnership. Originally, they basically were really geared towards energy retrofits of homes. With the City of Portland and a FEMA grant and with OEM, they basically did a pilot program to basically, while they're doing the energy work, they would seismically tie down houses to foundations. They just completed that program where they did 23 houses. It was so successful from the point of view of Clean Energy Works that this is one of the services they're going to be offering even without the subsidies they got from FEMA. And they're looking about trying to expand this program statewide, and it would, and this is one thing where in the future, if there was funding from the state to help this process go forward, it would be quite effective. And it basically helps Mayor Endicott with having fewer people going to Redmond after the earthquake.
That's right.
Another interesting presentation was actually from a OPB, and this is where I want. Oh, you've done this. two members of OPB staff worked with us, a group called Hack Oregon, and it really literally means, hacking computers and that stuff. They do it for nice purposes. And they developed, and this just came out, and it's online at the OPB website. It's called Aftershock, Find Your Quake History. And basically, it's right there. This map right here shows the Capitol building, that red dot. So you can go onto this site, put in your own address, and you can find out so if you scroll down, you can see what the impact of a cascading impact would be. The intensity here is 4 out of 6. It tells you about ground deformation. And then they basically mined the Oregon Resilience Plan and all our wonderful data and said, well, how resilient is your community? And basically they did our various task force, water and waste, water distribution, electricity, natural gas, police and fire, healthcare facilities and top priorities. This is how long it will take recovery, the estimates from the Oregon Resilience Plan. So it tells you how you're about your community. And then they said, well, how can we prepare for this? And if we were actually a single-family residence and there were only a family, we would need 2 weeks of supplies, 14 gallons of water per person, and 42 meals to prepare. And so multiply that by the number of people here in the building at the moment. That's quite a bit. So we asked them what's happening to this. OPB is basically committed to actually continuing to work with Hack Oregon, and they're going to be updating and revising this. I was flabbergasted because this is one of the recommendations that we put in the Oregon Resilience Plan, was to have some sort of way for community outreach, some way for that the citizens could understand what we were doing and compare where they were living to some other place and really understand this process. And here it is. And it's a tool that can be made better. And so it's quite extraordinary. I would welcome that, suggest that everyone go in and put your address in and find out. This also speaks to the submitted remarks, which is that basically, referencing a House Bill 3447, as LCDC works with coastal communities on tsunami resilience planning, one of the big takeaways of the Oregon Resilience Plan was interdependencies. And these examples basically show how what's needed, all these different areas, efforts, certainly by the Tillamook County on its land use, the efforts by Mayor Endicott. All these things are happening, and they need to be tied together. And I was just mentioning state agencies need to reach out. Another thing that I learned from the presentation this morning is that there actually is a governor's resilience cabinet, which is something that was new to me.
Really?
And this is basically something that arose out of developing this, trying to go after the HUD grants for resilience money. And so basically this is now done at the governor's office and bringing together people who need to tie these sorts of efforts together. So we're moving in the right direction. I also make a plug for Public Works to the land use planners. It's easy just to be wrapped up in planning, and just kind of a plea that one of the big elements that for this effort, really, let's bring in Public Works people really early, because it's really important. And this, it's they not only the big ticket items, they also have funding mechanisms in place, which basically will help pay for things in the long term. The question that was posed by Brian Gwinney when he asked me to come was basically make recommendations. I assume that would be for the 2016 session. So I developed a list of three, basically, in a short session. They're not big ticket items, but they're all important. One was basically strengthening telecommunication systems for that critical 3-week period. One is just to review what we're doing and how well it'll work. The other thing is it may be a suggestion to requiring that cell towers have backup for 3 weeks, since cell phone usage is really our primary means of communication. If we could keep them for 3 weeks online, that would be really helpful. The other thing is the safety assessment program. Oregon has kind of a half program. We asked BCD, back in 2005, to keep a list of design professionals who can go out and check buildings to see and tag them with this green, red, and yellow system that's already been developed. But the list is kind of decrepit at the moment, and there's really no integration with how this works with communities, how communities could basically ask for this, get help, and how and institutionalize this. This system has been really spearheaded by California. They have a quite robust one. This was recently adopted by the state of Oregon, and I think it's time Oregon basically joined in with our other two neighboring states and truly implemented this. BCD has estimated that it would take two staff people to run a similar type of program. And the other thing is, hopefully a simple process is to change the name of the committee, which instead of the House Veterans and Emergency Preparedness, that it's the Veterans and Disaster Resilience Committee, to really reflect the work that you're going to be doing. And I suppose there's another plea is that maybe that we could change the name of OSPAC too. It's too long and not really representative of what we're doing. And with that, I thank you for your continued work.
I think that the suggested name would help also just from the standpoint of keeping it in the forefront of that, so that we're talking about kind of the progress that needs to be made in this resiliency versus it's kind of, in some kinds when we think about emergency, we think about in and out and we're done with it versus I think what resiliency does. So it's probably a pretty good idea that would raise that awareness. So thank you.
Chair Lively, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Matt Spangler. I'm a coastal policy analyst with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. I work out of the department's coastal field office over in Newport. We did provide the committee with written testimony today. So what I'd like to do is just take a few minutes and kind of summarize a few of the high points of that testimony. Appreciate the invitation to appear before the committee today. I'm going to talk primarily about tsunami planning work that the department is engaged in right now. But before I do that specifically, just by way of introduction, I'd like to acknowledge the work of a couple of our partner agencies and state government entities. First of all, the folks at the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, the Doug Gammy folks that produced the latest version of the tsunami inundation maps, the TIMS as we call them. Really, those maps are really a state-of-the-art product for evaluating tsunami risk, and really the work that we're advancing with local governments in terms of the local planning couldn't be done without that mapping product. Also plug the smartphone app that Tsunami has created for the inundation maps. Y'all visit the coast, right? So you want to have that app on your phone. You can, anywhere you are on the coast, you can call up the inundation map, see where you are in relation to the inundation zone. You can see where you need to go to evacuate. So when the ground shaking stops, you got about 15 to 20 minutes to get to high ground. So. Recommend you download the app for your travels to the coast. The other piece of work that I like to plug for our friends at Doug Gammy is their time distance modeling work, which they're calling beat the wave modeling, that they're engaged in right now. That work has only just barely begun. They've completed that work for just a handful of communities. That's basically evacuation performance modeling. It tells us in various communities from different locations what sort of the state of the performance is of the evacuation system, and just, you know, bottom line, whether folks can get out in certain locations, and if they can or cannot, what is needed in terms of system improvements to make that system function. So again, super important for a lot of the planning work that we're engaging in right now with local governments. And then, of course, there's the excellent work of the Oregon Resilience Plan and the recommendations that came out of that, and among other things, the land use recommendations that came out of that, really directing a lot of the work that we're doing right now in relation to tsunami planning. One of the recommendations that came out of the plan was for the department to develop the guidance document for local government tsunami planning. And Commissioner Labhart referred to that document in his presentation. And my understanding from Brian is that you've all been provided a copy of this document. And it's also web-based, so it's up on our website. That's really our primary means of distribution right now. So if you want to take a look at that in your spare time, you can dial it up on our website. What the land use guidance really is sort of a suite of different approaches that local governments can use to address tsunami hazard, specifically in their comprehensive planning and land use based programs. So lots of other work going on in other areas of emergency preparedness, but of course our area of expertise really is in the comprehensive planning field, so that's really what the guidance is designed to address. Key concepts in the land use guidance, the number one is the linkage between the provision of adequate evacuation infrastructure and the comprehensive planning process. So in the same ways that communities plan for sewer, they plan for water, they plan for other elements of their transportation system, and they integrate that with their land use planning, there's techniques and suggestions provided in the guidance document about how they can make that same connection with the evacuation infrastructure in the community. There's provisions for traditional zoning approaches, and that is in the form of a model hazard overlay zone that's provided in the guidance document. And then there's also a sort of a range of suggestions related to incentives that local governments could employ to basically provide development incentives for safer, more resilient, better located development related to tsunami. Right now, we're in the process kind of shopping this guidance around on the coast with a number of different local communities. We've had quite a bit of interest from communities to use and adapt various pieces of that. Probably the furthest along right now in that process would be Clatsop County. They've convened a process, appointed an advisory committee. We're participating in that effort, providing technical assistance and support, and that's actually moving along really well. So. Kudos to the staff up in your neck of the woods, Representative Boone. The folks at Clatsop County Community Development doing a really good job on that project. We're really hopeful that that effort will result in maybe a handful, we hope, of sort of pilot efforts by local governments to take some of the concepts in the land use guidance, put them in place on the ground out there and see how they really work. We'd be the first ones to tell you that we're not really entirely clear on how some of this stuff might work or not, depending on how it's adapted for use at the local level. When we developed the guidance, we did a lot of research, really, frankly, internationally from our consultants, and there's really been very little work done in this particular area. So a lot of the concepts in the guidance we think are promising, but the jury's still out on those, really, in terms of how they're really going to work when we actually employ them down at the local level. Let me summarize by just identifying a few key points that we've learned kind of in this process so far. I think the first point that we've learned is that probably the most immediate and pressing opportunity for local governments in relation to land use planning approaches is to make that connection between evacuation, facility planning, and your land use process. There's been lots of work done on evacuation planning and preparedness, but there's been very little done to connect that with what's happening in your development review process, and are you making adequate provision for tsunami evacuation systems and needed improvements in cases where that system might be deficient. The second point is that this whole field of tsunami hazard planning really presents some very unique challenges. It's not like other chronic hazards that we address through the land use planning and zoning process. If you think about this tsunami event, it has this multi-hundreds of years recurrence interval. We haven't had one since settlement patterns really began on the coast, so we've got something going on a couple centuries of community development patterns that are well established out there in these coastal communities. And those have all happened really without any knowledge or frankly regard for the level of risk posed by this tsunami event. So when you start with that particular deck of cards, that presents some real unique challenges for how we go about planning and trying to address that hazard going forward. And finally, I'd like to reinforce the point that Commissioner Labhard made, and that is that all of this tsunami resilience measures related to comprehensive planning have to be implemented at the local level. That's really the only way they can be done. And all of our coastal communities basically are small communities. They have limited resources. They have limited capacity. They got a lot on their plate, so they're going to need help. We, along with our partners at Dogami, Oregon Emergency Management, other folks, can provide the technical assistance and support, but the local governments are going to need financial resources to get this work done. So with that, I will conclude my remarks, and when the time comes, I'll be happy to respond to questions.
Thank you. Mr. McCoy is going to tell us how that's all going to come together.
Chair Lively, members of the committee, I am Steve McCoy, representing 1,000 Friends of Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on this life or death issue, as it actually is. So I'm afraid I'm going to be very quickly trotting some well-trodden ground. So we've talked about the Oregon Resilience Plan as work that's going on, excellent work of OSPAC. Matt just talked about this guidance document that DLCD has produced, which is also a very important piece of work. Dogami, the clearinghouse for geological hazard information, they've done lots of mapping. The Slido maps are fantastic, really amazing. And then, of course, they work with FEMA on flood hazards. There's already floodplain mitigation that's done as part of the National Flood Insurance Program through FEMA. Building codes do discourage some construction in tsunami areas. And then, of course, OEM has provided quite a bit of education, a lot of things behind the scenes as well, but not things that are hitting the ground at this point. So we've mapped hazards. We've raised awareness. By the way, I suggest you go look at, if you haven't seen it, OEM has this comic book called Without Warning that is an educational piece that is aimed at kids, and it is creepy and fascinating.
A comic book, though.
Yes, a comic book, Without Warning. And then there's been some guidance provided to local governments from DLCD about certain natural hazards. And some local governments have stepped up. Tillamook County, great example. Commissioner Lapark got to really say what they have done in that community is really amazing and really forward-looking. And, of course, the vast majority of the work is focused on tsunamis and earthquakes. So Oregon does have 19 statewide planning goals, and I want to talk how this fits, how all this fits in within the land use program. So the goals are not, they are guidance. The goals themselves are guidance. Most of the goals have some sort of implementation underneath them, either in statute or in rule, or in a lot of them, both. And so once you have that implementation in statute or rule, then you start having requirements on local governments. So generally there are standards that can be met so that the process can be completed, safe harbor so the process can be completed more easily. For example, if Tillamook County's was used as a template, if they're, the work that they've done was used as a template, that could be the safe harbor, as an example. So the goals have to do with all sorts of things all over the state, with natural resources, with agricultural lands, with forest lands, with wildlife, which is in Goal 5, and then, of course, the coastal resources. Goals 16 through 19 are coastal resources. There's citizen participation, there's urbanization, there's transportation, there's energy conservation, there are all sorts of things. And you can see goal 7 right here is areas subject to natural hazards. So we already have a goal out there that reaches this area. However, again, that is one of the goals that is not implemented under the land use program. Hmm. And it covers a wide range of things. In addition to tsunamis and earthquakes and coastal erosion and landslides, this is OSO, by the way. And this is actually also, this is along the Oregon coast. It also does coastal and riverine flooding and wildfires. So issues, there are issues with natural hazards, obviously, throughout the state. But since we're talking about tsunamis today, I wanted to talk about, so House Bill 2633 has come up in this discussion. It has about a $200,000 fiscal on it. It is sitting in Ways and Means. And what it would do is it would push LCDC, who technically is the one that does the rulemaking, push them to do a rulemaking on tsunamis, coastal erosion, and landslides. And with some bounds, there are some bounds on it, what would be done. And then also for all of the other types of natural hazards that are included in Goal 7, to have those, have them provide guidance on those. So more requirements for erosion, coastal erosion, tsunamis, and landslides, and then guidance on the others. So this would be sort of a kickoff of Goal 7 work. It would get the ball rolling. It would get some things done. And since this will be a multi-decade piece of work to get, not for the rulemaking, but to get the implementation done, it's a really important piece of work. I wanted to mention one thing. Mayor Endicott mentioned, he said something about trading out lands, for example. That's the sort of thing that we would expect to see in this, that there would have to be planning flexibility for these issues, whether that's transfer of development rights, whether that's just trading blocks of land out of UGB. That would be up to the local government. It wouldn't be, as Representative Parrish said, scooping up people and moving them somewhere else. It would be a matter of the local government collaborating with the local people on what is the thing that makes the most sense for that particular local area. And I think that's all that I had. Yes, it is.
Okay. Questions? Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. McCoy, on 2633, from what you did hear Commissioner Labhart talk about, is there sort of a yin and yang with those two, his county's ordinance and 2633?
So, Chair Lively, Representative Boone, I would expect to see that used as a starting point or perhaps as a template. I would expect that work, so the way that I would envision the rulemaking taking place would be Dogami, OEM, DLCD, Department of Forestry, potentially Department of Ag, and hazard folks, CERT folks, all sorts of folks sitting in a room and saying, hey, where do we want to get to? And then a discussion of how to get to that spot. So if the Tillamook County plans make sense, or maybe even use that as a stopgap until we can get to a different spot. I don't think there's any, I don't want to put any bounds on what would happen in that rulemaking, because I do think that it's important to get the smart people that know about these issues, know about hazards, into a room and get them talking about these things. I mean, I know that that's been done to a large degree, but actually about the exact steps to take and actually now one step forward taking those steps.
Thank you.
Representative Parrish.
And I'm sorry, I'm looking at the bill that Rep. Boone, mm-hmm. you've all referenced. It's the first time I've had a chance to look at it. Ultimately, what rules are you trying to, or you hope that they come up with? I mean, every community is obviously going to be different based on their needs. But in your mind, what does that rulemaking process actually look like? And what's the deliverable that you hope comes out of that rulemaking process?
Chair Lively, Representative Parrish, what I would expect would be, well, so it, for example, talks about safe harbors. In Section 2, there's a section there that talks about safe harbors. I think it's in the first paragraph of that. And talks about how there have to be ways for local governments to be able to implement this in essentially a cookie-cutter manner. So that would be perhaps taking, for example, Tillamook County's template and using that elsewhere. That could be, for example, the safe harbor. And then also just... rules saying, hey, local government, this is where you need to get to, essentially. This is what you need to get to with routes away, you know, for example, with routes away from inundation zones, those sorts of things. And probably bringing in transportation planning as well. Beyond just the foot traffic of getting out of there, but also transportation planning for a resilient transportation system.
To follow up?
Sure.
I mean, I guess I feel like that's already going on without a bill to actually do that work. And this provides a $50,000, and I know we're not here to talk about this bill specifically, but since we brought it up, ask for $50,000 to sort of carry out what feels a little more like a task force, even though it doesn't say that, but just saying, hey, you're going to engage in this rulemaking. But the bill actually doesn't say what the outcomes of that rulemaking needs to look like. Like, it just, you know, talks about having accurate, you know, identification of these areas. I think we know where that's at. I've been in 5 years of this committee where a lot of what you're talking about, we already do. So this feels redundant to me, and I guess I just don't understand what the purpose is.
Chair Lively, Representative Parrish, the thing that has not taken place is a rulemaking to make it so that local governments actually implement something. Some have done it on their own. Tillamook County, for example, many others have not done it. And that's what this is. That is that next step, saying, hey, local governments, or hey, you need DLCD, make rules so that local governments actually do implementation on the ground.
Follow-up. Sure. Why would Land Conservation and Development be asking, like, be directing rulemaking for seismic and resilience? We have OEM and we have other agencies who do that. This seems totally outside of their wheelhouse.
Chair Lively, Representative Parrish, those other groups do not do comprehensive planning. They don't actually do the planning on the ground of cities. They do other types of planning, but they do not do this type of planning. And so it's exactly what the Department of Land Conservation and Development does.
I'm still wrapping my head around what this type of planning actually means. Like,
land,
I haven't actually...
Land use planning.
So are we talking about land use planning post a disaster? Or are we talking about what the land use planning should look like?
I think it's a process.
Going into
a process of getting all these groups around the issue and helping to guide a process of moving forward with this thing looming over us in mind.
So So if I might add, so if I'm getting correctly here, we have within our current land use system and goals the ability to do this planning. We haven't historically done, we used Goal 7 specifically, but what we're saying is we already have, all this is kind of allowed for in the current land use planning system we have and the goals, and so now it's a matter of taking those and making sure we're taking them to the next level for those that actually apply to tsunamis, earthquakes, et cetera, that cities, communities, counties all have plans in place to comply with whatever it is that we're trying to comply with. And one of the things you keep talking about is safe harbor, so we don't have to everybody reinvent the tool, but can use things that work someplace. Am I capturing this?
Chair Lively, yes, that is correct.
So can I follow up? So if these goals came out of Senate Bill 100, I believe, right? Or is that the original sort of land use planning?
So
wouldn't land use folks already have the ability to make some administrative rules since the goals are already law without another bill?
Chair Lively, Representative Parrish. So Senate Bill 100 was passed in 1973, and one of the things that it did was it told LCDC to come up with goals, to go hold meetings around the state and come up with the goals. Within the next 2 years, by 1975, LCDC had sent people out throughout the state. They had talked with over 10,000 people in the state and come up with these goals. So the goals came out in 1975, essentially. Mm-hmm. And Goal 7 has been sitting there on the books since 1975. There have been a few local governments, for example, Tillamook County, that have actually implemented Goal 7 in their land use plans, in their comprehensive plans. Others have just said, just a little boilerplate saying, gosh, Goal 7 is important and we should plan for natural hazards, and then kind of moved on and not really done anything with Goal 7. So this would make it so that folks, the local governments, would be taking Goal 7 into account. Again, this first round for tsunamis, coastal erosion, and landslides, and not for the other natural hazards at this point.
I guess this last follow-up comment, nobody has to respond, but if we're going to direct the agency to make rules to make counties implement Goal 7, I mean, $50,000 that's for the agency. That's sort of an unfunded mandate to your local cities and counties to actually have to do the work.
I would think cities and counties would probably have argued over the last several years that there might be, from a land use planning standpoint, a lot of things they were required to do that were unfunded mandates.
Sure.
So I think that is part of the whole conversation about land use planning and how we roll it out and who's kind of responsible. I think one of the things we're hearing here now, though, is given the importance of all this with this planning for the earthquake or tsunami and the resiliency plan, so how do we take the next steps to encourage, to support, to make sure those things are there? And you may be raising a very interesting question. And I think especially in the coastal communities, given the size of those communities, the role for the state may be, we're going to have to help to make some investments so that they can complete those plans and have those things in place. Otherwise, the time it will take to get there may be much longer. So one thing we can do is, yes, say, okay, we're going to have the rules to fully implement Goal 7. But the other thing we may have to do is say, in order to do that, we recognize the burden that places regardless. And we may have to work with those communities somehow. The state plays some role in helping ensure the finances are there to hire the consultants, whoever they need to do the planning to do that.
I guess, and this bill's not up for debate, obviously, in our committee, but I just think that before we would have a bill saying we're going to make rules to implement something that's in some goal from 40 years ago, to do an inventory of what people have and haven't done. Like, the bill still feels cart before the horse to me, because so in another universe, we used to sell, Mark's family used to sell manufactured homes. We used to site those homes at the coast. Mm-hmm. There were very specific rules for where you could and couldn't site based on, this was 20 years ago, based on land use planning, understanding what a disaster zone's gonna look like, and you couldn't just site willy-nilly. And so I feel like cities and counties on the coast have done a lot of this work. Before we start to overlay a bunch of rulemaking, I think it would make sense to actually take an inventory of what work's already been done, and this seems like there's a missing piece for me. And obviously, again, this not...
So you, Mr. Raskin, do you have something to add to this, or Mr. Spangler?
I would like to comment.
Certainly.
Yes, thank you, Chair Lively. Representative Parrish, I think that's a really good question. So I guess I want to be clear that... I don't think it's really accurate to say that Goal 7 has never been implemented. Now, some of our statewide planning goals have more specific implementing rules associated with them in order to clarify and provide additional guidance to local governments. Other goals do not. Goal 7, at this point, does not have additional rules associated with it. However, all local governments have acknowledged comprehensive plans. They've all addressed Goal 7 in some fashion or other in their plan. Mm-hmm. Now, some, as Steve indicated, some have done a more current and thorough job of doing that than others. But for example, one of the purposes of our land use guidance on tsunami is that we appreciate the kind of newly appreciated urgency for communities to mm-hmm. address tsunami. And so we're trying to provide them with tools to do that. But most of what's in the guidance is probably not universally appropriate for all communities on the coast, but there are bits and pieces that can be adapted and tailored, and that's really the approach that we used in the guidance.
Mr. Raskin?
Yes, I wanted to essentially second that opinion. Is that a lot? I think that when this was actually the goals were put out, there was a question about whether this should be mandatory or not, and the wisdom at the time was that it should be more voluntary. It should be more of a guidance rather than rule, and I think that has been the right approach. The other hat that I've worn in the past is as a city councilor and mayor of Cannon Beach. So, and as an architect, I've worked in other coastal communities. In terms of most of the natural hazards that the coast faces, in terms of geological hazards, landslides, flooding, that's pretty much covered in almost all these the comprehensive plan and the zoning ordinances. The ones that haven't been were ones that we've really just discovered recently, which is the tsunami earthquake. And in actual fact, I think the fact that each community on the coast in terms of these risks is really quite different, mm-hmm. that actually this bottom-up approach is at the moment more productive than a top-down approach. That there are lots of, and Tillamook County is an example of it, Cannon Beach has certainly been an example of that. And I think that at a certain point in time, the state might want to come back at the state level and say which have been the most effective experiments that have been out there and how does this all really work, and then standardize things at that time. But I would say that it's a little, at least for a little bit longer, let's see what the coastal communities are coming up with. And rather than putting money into the rulemaking part of it, is put that funding into the coastal communities, helping to help them figure out what they need to do. Most coastal communities, whether they've done things or not, are actually very aware of what their risk and vulnerabilities are. And with a little help about how to figure this thing out, I think we'll have to do quite a good job.
It all kind of goes back to this timing thing and how much time we have and how much we can, if we even agree what that is, how much we can prepare in order to do that. But I think you raise a very good point about the ability already, or the knowledge already on the coast, and what a role the state, how we might help or not help support that.
Chair Lively, there's actually one other thing. As I mentioned it earlier, is that the federal government is now coming down with this community resilience planning guidelines.
Yeah.
And this is going to be starting to focus what states are going to have to do and local communities as well, because this is standards and performances that are going to basically be adopted nationwide. And those, whatever these points are going to basically start impacting Oregon and in all communities.
And we're hoping those will be similar to what we're already doing.
Well, you can read the draft and you can extrapolate from there.
Chair Lively, members of the committee, I wanted to follow up on a couple of things. One is, it is accurate to say that they have not been implemented at the state level. That Goal 7 has not been implemented at the state level. The goals are, the case law says that the goals are not mandatory at local level. So whenever they put something into their comprehensive plan, there's no teeth there, essentially. There's no teeth on Goal 7 to be able to come back and say, hey, you haven't adequately addressed this. And as far as money goes, agreed, this will cost money. And what we have done is the partners that we've had on this bill, the people that we have worked with on this bill, realize that, and the money, however, is not for this this biennium. So the rulemaking would take place this biennium, and then the grant money mm-hmm. would have to appear in future bienniums. And it wouldn't be everybody on the coast, for example, having to do all the planning at the same time. What I would expect from a rulemaking would be rolling this out so that it could be done in a logic, some sort of logical progression.
So, I'm sorry, I'm looking at the fiscal impact for 2633. The $50,000 request is this biennium. That's what the fiscal impact of the engrossed actually said. So it's not in a subsequent biennium, like make the rules and go do that. Because I would expect if goals, any of these goals are part of the, DLCD mission, essentially, they exist to help facilitate this. But this is just something they should absorb and do. If they haven't made rulemaking, that's what they have staff for. It doesn't necessarily need a new influx of money in it. You know, certainly doesn't require an FT, but this does say 17, and I just sort of go back to, I feel like we're cart before a horse on this bill, and we're not hearing this bill right now, but you presented it to us, so we get to comment now. So, maybe not what you're anticipating, but...
Sorry, Mr. McCoy, that you
yeah,
did that.
Sorry. But, you know, for me, what does $50,000 do in a community like Rep. Boone's, who, you know, frankly, we... have really underfunded a lot of this issue on the coast for years, and it's taking her years to get stuff, just really basic stuff done, to support her community, and she's like sort of a sole flag waver on this. This doesn't feel like a good use of our dollars in a biennium where we're already hearing over and over again, we're tight on funds. I mean, like, get the money to the local communities, let them do the work. I mean, a bureaucracy at the state, people who don't even live on the coast, making a bunch of rules for, you know, to solve this, doesn't feel like an effective use of our money. So,
Representative Parrish, sure. You may get a chance to vote on this, or you may not, depending on whether it comes out of the committee or not.
I know.
Well, Chair Lively, Representative Parrish, I was, in fact, in Representative Boone's district on last Wednesday. In Astoria, I was on a panel speaking with Bonnie Henderson, who wrote a book called The Next Tsunami, Life on a Restless Coast. And there was a room full of people there in Astoria that wanted to talk about natural hazards, and they wanted to see, they said, and actually to be clear, the $50,000 that's in the bill, there's $150,000 fiscal on top of that. So it's actually $200,000 that DLCD has said that they would need this biennium to do the rulemaking. And everybody there said, $200,000? Why can't they find $200,000 in this multi-billion dollar budget to help us out at the coast? And they thought it was absolutely ridiculous that they couldn't find $200,000 to get this rulemaking done. So I do think that that there is support for this on the coast. And also, again, the grant money for the local governments to actually implement this would be next biennium, not this biennium.
So we've run out of time. Thank you very much. It's helpful just to get a better grasp on how complex this is, but also keep reinforcing how important the work is, and probably the role for the state, whether it be financial or others, is going to become bigger and bigger, and certainly to help communities along the coast. They're a great example because they're the most
That's
at
right
risk
there.
At this point. But I appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you for inviting us.
Thanks a lot. Sure.
And I think that I just want to add to this, Mr. Chair, that Steve was at the meeting where Commissioner Leanne Thompson was, I think, mm-hmm. or she would have been here today.
Oh,
so.
Okay.
Thank you.
Sure. Close this meeting. Thank you.
No, thank you. Fascinating.
Close this meeting. Thank you.
No, thank you. Fascinating.